Welcome back to Tiger Talk, everyone. This is Carney Ann Nassar, and I hope that wherever you are, you're healthy and you are safe. Today, we're going to get a look at why the U.S. Department of Agriculture shoulders so much of the blame for the exploitation of tigers and other exotic animals here in the United States. My guest today is one of my very dearest friends, Delcy Winders. She is the professor of animal law up at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland, Oregon, where she's the director of the Animal Litigation Clinic. She is largely responsible for my animal law career. We spent years together at the PETA Foundation, where she was the vice president and deputy general counsel for captive animal law enforcement. And we collaborated together on creative legal strategies in order to rescue exotic animals from abuse, exploitation, and the entertainment industry. Delcy is one of the leading experts on the topic of federal agency regulation and all the ways that federal agencies fail at their jobs when it comes to enforcing regulations related to animal welfare. So she's going to very explicitly eviscerate the U.S. Department of Agriculture and explain all of the ways that they bear responsibility, in some cases 100%, for the types of chronic abuse that we see in roadside zoos like Joe Exotics facility. So let's get to some Tiger Talk with Professor Delcy Winders.
I guess I was thinking I could start with a little background, and I guess starting with the disclosure that I have not been able to stomach watching all of the show. I've watched about half of it, and you know, once it became quite clear that it was not about the animals, it's about these men and their antics and disregards the suffering of the animals, I have not yet forced myself to watch it. But what's become clear is that because it does not focus on the animals and what they've endured, it doesn't focus on who is complicit in that. And a big, big part of that picture is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And I think I can go into the different aspects of that and the licensing issues, the enforcement issues, the transparency issues. And I think, I mean, Joe is like a perfect example of that because
rock and roll. Like, so I'm curious. So in terms of responsibility of like, who really is accountable for the current situation that we have with roadside zoos in the United States, like what percentage responsibility do you think the USDA has to shoulder?
I think the USDA has a huge, huge, huge responsibility because we have so few laws protecting these animals. And one of the only laws, and certainly the most significant law that we have, is the Animal Welfare Act. And that has been on the books for many years. The USDA has sole responsibility for enforcing that act. We don't have a citizen supervision, which is something I want to talk about. So the USDA has primary responsibility. So yes, these men and their, you know, all of the things that they've done, they bear responsibility, and the public bears some responsibility for its complicity, but far and away, the USDA shoulders most of it. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife also has some responsibility. I mean, there's never been any doubt that the Endangered Species Act applies to captive wildlife. The agency has acknowledged that and struggled with how to apply it, but they have never used it to regulate in a meaningful way the conditions of these animals. So they have some responsibility as well, but far and away, the USDA shoulders the bulk of the responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you explain a little bit about what the Animal Welfare Act is supposed to do and in on paper and what happens in actuality?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of your listeners probably have some basic working knowledge of the Animal Welfare Act, but just to start at the beginning for those who don't, the Animal Welfare Act is a federal law that operates through a licensing and inspection regime. So in order to engage in a number of commercial activities with animals, including commercial breeding, exhibition and research. And so all of the men who are featured in Tiger King are engaged in exhibition as well as commercial breeding. So because of that, they are required to have a license under the Animal Welfare Act, and they are required to go through routine inspections to assess compliance with minimum welfare standards. So the USDA issues licenses on an annual basis, and they inspect anywhere from, you know, if you're a chronic violator, you should be getting inspected several times a year. Some folks are only inspected once every 5 years under their current practices. And that's to determine whether you're complying with very, very basic regulatory standards, like providing veterinary care, providing adequate food. These are not rigorous demands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your response when a lot of these roadside zoos say, well, we're federally licensed and inspected, is
that doesn't really mean anything. That means you're complying with the bare minimums of the law. You're not blatantly violating that particular legal requirement, but really all it takes to get an Animal Welfare Act license is paying a trivial license fee, a license fee that has not been adjusted even for inflation in decades. So it's cheaper now to get a license than it ever has been in real dollars. And it doesn't even cost the agency, they don't even cover their cost of issuing that license through the licensing fee, let alone their cost of inspecting, et cetera. So it's very meaningless. And the Animal Welfare Act clearly requires that in order to get a license, you have to demonstrate compliance with the Animal Welfare Act regulatory standards. And that has become pretty meaningless as well. Certainly in the context of license renewal, the USDA has renewed licenses over and over again, including for all of the men featured in Tiger King when they are known to be in violation of the statute. But even in the first instance, I mean, the USDA gave Joe his first license on the heels of a botched rescue in which he shot emus he was supposed to be rescuing and injured a bunch of others. The USDA gave Tim Stark a license after he pled guilty to trafficking in endangered ocelots. So it's truly meaningless.
Yeah. So you said that Joe is sort of a perfect example and poster child for all the ways in which USDA is failing to enforce the Federal Animal Welfare Act or make it more meaningful. What are some of the most significant ways that you think Joe is an example of those failures?
Where to begin? So certainly he never should have been given a license by the USDA to exhibit animals in the first place. In order to engage in this business that he engaged in for years, he needed that Animal Welfare Act license. And as I said, they gave it to him immediately on the heels of this botched rescue. So it never should have been given to him at all. Then almost immediately they started citing him for violations of the minimal standards. And yet every year, like clockwork, they automatically renewed his license. And there was a flicker of hope in 2006 when he actually did face a rare enforcement action. Usually the USDA does not enforce the Animal Welfare Act, even in the face of egregious violations. And its own inspector general has found this over and over again. When it does take enforcement, it's usually in the form of a warning, which is very meaningless. Sometimes it will do discounted penalties. And so the act itself provides for pretty significant penalties and a lot of enforcement options to the agency. The agency has just chosen not to exercise those. But in 2006, it did fine Joe $25,000. It temporarily suspended his license. And most importantly, Joe agreed that if he were to violate the Animal Welfare Act in the following 18 months, his license would be revoked, permanently revoked. Mm-hmm. The thing is, he did continue violating the Animal Welfare Act. The agency cited him, and notably, PETA did an undercover investigation and documented a slew of violations, things that we now know were routine there. Healthy tigers were being killed. Animals were regularly escaping. A tiger had, one tiger chewed off a lion's leg. Another tiger pulled out her stitches from her open wound, and she just laid there crying for weeks without veterinary care. declawed tiger cubs had to interact with the public, and they were bleeding on the public. Tiger cubs with ringworm were interacting with the public. Tigers were struck with rakes and shovels. They were routinely sprayed with cold water. They were kicked. They were punched. Slew of violations documented. Evidence provided to the USDA. The USDA was reminded that they were under this agreement that if he violated the act, his license would be permanently revoked. And the agency did nothing. They had him dead to rights and they did nothing. So as far as I'm concerned, certainly at that point, any violations that happened thereafter, the USDA has blood on its hands. The USDA is absolutely complicit in those and likely in all of the violations that happened before. And shortly after that, 23 tiger cubs died over the course of 7 months, probably many more, but we at least know about those 23. The USDA finally opened investigation into those deaths and didn't do anything with it. So at the time Joe was convicted, the agency had 4 open investigations, many of which had been open for years and years and years, and they would had just been sitting on them.
And renewing his license.
Exactly. Further compounding the problem, not only not doing anything about the violations, but renewing his license year after year, allowing him to continue to engage in these practices. So it's absolutely complicit. And it cannot be said that the agency didn't know about this. I mean, I've been working on these issues for 15 years, and I guarantee you we were submitting evidence to the agency. We were submitting evidence of his trafficking, of his illegal sales of cats, both to USDA and to Fish and Wildlife. We were submitting evidence of his records and his inventory that was constantly shifting. So the agency absolutely knew about this and continued, affirmatively authorized it, put its stamp of approval on it. So that's what having a USDA license means. Whew.
Where do you even get us from there? So what do you think would have happened? Like, if it weren't for this case, do you think the USDA ever would have done anything?
If it weren't for the murder for hire allegations?
Yeah. If it wasn't for, you know, the Department of Justice and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and FBI finally stepping in and stopping this, then do you think the USDA actually ever would have done anything with those 4 investigations?
I think it's exceedingly unlikely. I mean, the USDA actually did not do anything with those investigations, and that's a pattern. I mean, you know, they did that with Ringling Brothers. They would sit on them and then say, oh, the statute of limitations has run, so we can't do anything. No, I don't think so. I think because human interests were implicated, that got higher interest, and the DOJ getting involved certainly helped. But the DOJ has an animal unit that's been wanting to work with USDA on numerous cases beyond just dogfighting for years now. And from what I understand, the USDA has thrown roadblocks up there. So even when you have folks trying to help, the USDA doesn't cooperate, and the USDA wants to help these folks stay in business rather than hold them accountable.
And it seems like the problem's gotten worse, right? Like, it seems like the USDA has always been functionally pretty industry friendly. But it now seems like rather than enforcing the Animal Welfare Act and, you know, ensuring the humane care and treatment of animals like they are supposed to do, it seems like that USDA has turned into like an industry advocacy group. So what's your take on that? And what are some of the ways that it has made a turn for the even worse in recent years?
Yeah. So I think you're right. It's absolutely gotten worse. It's worse than it has ever been. But I think it's important to underscore that it has never, ever been good. The Animal Welfare Act has been on the books for more than 50 years. It has never been properly enforced. And the Inspector General has been saying that over and over again. So the Inspector General raised the alarm about this automatic license renewal issue that I was talking about in 1992, almost three decades ago. It has raised the alarm about enforcement issues, saying that the agency only charges pennies on the dollar for violations at that, and that industry treats them as a, quote, cost of doing business. So this isn't new, but yes, you're right. It is worse than ever. So among other things, we have seen a precipitous decline in enforcement actions. So on enforcement actions, the agency was being condemned by its Inspector General for over-reliance on settlements where they discounted penalties. I was also coming after them pretty aggressively for their heavy reliance on warnings, because warnings were the primary so-called enforcement tool. And I published an article where I did an analysis of subsequent compliance behavior by entities who had faced a warning. And not surprisingly, they continued to violate the law, and USDA did not do anything. If they did anything, they would issue another warning, sometimes multiple subsequent warnings, every once in a while, a settlement discounted penalty. And so the agency stopped doing even these things. And I, in fact, had the head of animal care say to me, well, you agree that warnings aren't working, so we're just not going to do them anymore. The problem was, I was recommending that they ratchet things up the pyramid, the enforcement pyramid, that if someone disregards a warning, then you fine them, you suspend their license, you revoke their license. If you need to, you seek criminal penalties. You keep working up the line so that those bad apples are eventually forced to come into compliance. But the agency instead said, we're just not going to do anything. So we have fewer enforcement actions than ever occurring. On top of that, the agency is hiding those enforcement actions from the public. So we can't even hold them accountable to determine whether they're complying with the Inspector General's latest recommendations. The public can't make a determination about which businesses they might want to support based on their enforcement history. And then add to that, the agency has stopped citing all violations and inspections. So it used to be that at least we had the inspection reports and folks could step in and try and get help to these animals based on information from inspection reports. And fortunately, those access to those has been restored after huge fights and, you know, multiple lawsuits. Unlike access to the enforcement records, which are still not available, but the agency isn't documenting all the violations in the inspection reports. And one of the things that they're doing is a thing that's called teachable moments, where for certain violations, they're not putting them in the inspection report. They're putting them in an entirely separate document that until recently, when Congress forced the agency's hands, were being kept secret from the public. They're still using teachable moments, even though about 6 months ago, there was report language from Congress instructing the agencies to stop using teachable moments. They brazenly doubled down instead and expanded the circumstances in which they do use teachable moments. So now we have inspection reports that are extremely deceptive being posted online that say they brazenly doubled down instead and expanded the circumstances in which they do use teachable moments. So now we have inspection reports that are extremely deceptive being posted online that say that no violations were documented. We have entities who are actually going to the press and saying, look, we have a clean inspection report. We have a perfect compliance history, when in fact there are separately documented violations and nobody disputes that those are violations. So
saying that, you know, they're patting themselves on the back for saying, oh, 99% of our regulated entities are substantially in compliance with the Animal Welfare Act.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that's another piece of this. So they now, instead of enforcing and citing, they've created compliance officers who are supposed to be helping folks with compliance. And they've come up with this new concept of substantial compliance. So because folks aren't complying with the standards, even though they're the bare minimal standards, the agency has completely invented this category of substantial compliance. And they're using that to tout their success in bringing folks into quote unquote substantial compliance without disclosing how they're defining that term. And we know for a fact that they consider someone to be substantially compliant, even when they have critical violations that are impacting the welfare of animals. I mean, there was an instance where there was a ram whose bone was sticking out of his leg and the regulated entity hadn't even noticed. And the agency said, oh, that's substantially compliant. That's good enough for us. I guess they're being honest, at least for once.
Can you, even before things took a turn for them, like just almost, you know, it just defies all logic to know how bad things are at the USDA at this point. But just to paint the picture of how bad it was historically in terms of enforcement and the lack of deterrent effect that it had, can you give an example of where a license, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I suspect that you'll, but an example of a regulated entity actually facing enforcement and paying a penalty, but a de minimis penalty, something that's like almost absurd based on the violations.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull up a good example because I do, you know, because I've published on this and I give guest lectures a lot, I usually try to pull up recent and local examples because there's no shortage of examples. Let me just try and pull up some notes here and see if I can give you a quick one. Yeah, here I've got one from a lecture I did at NYU recently. Let's see.
I mean, I'm just thinking back to, you know, even I think it was the Carson and Barnes fine for a couple $100, right? That's not recent, like what you'll probably have right there, but that's just beyond the pale.
Yeah, I mean, they're truly stunning how de minimis these penalties are. So here's an example. So Bailiwick is a roadside zoo in New York in the Catskills, and they had they were facing an enforcement action for 8 violations that impacted numerous animals. So the Animal Welfare Act provides for penalties of $10,000 per day. That's actually been adjusted for inflation. So it's a little over $11,000 per day per violation per animal. So those can add up quite quickly. So they had 8 violations impacting numerous animals, including failing to provide enrichment to numerous primates, failing to provide vet care to a fox who they noticed was acting abnormally. She was wobbly, and instead of getting her to a vet, they put her in a dog crate and left her alone and found her dead the next day. So based on the animals impacted and the number of violations, they faced at least $210,000 in penalties. And oftentimes it's hard to figure out that number because they're not doing an adequate job of documenting the number of animals impacted or the number of days that they're impacted. So usually that even that estimate is going to be a low number. But it was at least $210,000 and they paid $1,350. That was less than 1 cent on the dollar of what they faced. And that's extremely typical. That is not an outlier example that I pulled. You can go through all of their settlements and they're pretty similar. Research facilities tend to pay a little bit more because they are not subject to license revocation and because they tend to be a little bit better resourced, but they're still discounted extremely, just pennies on the dollar. And for exhibitors, forget about it. I mean, it's virtually unheard of that there's a meaningful penalty. Tim Stark recently did get what sounds like a pretty significant penalty, but I think, you know, that was in the context of an administrative law judge decision, which is very rare for the USDA to seek. And I think still, even when you look at the number of violations that he had, it's still very low. Similarly, Ringling Brothers was assessed the highest penalty of any animal exhibitor ever. And that was still extremely, extremely discounted in terms of what they could have paid. And they were a very well-resourced organization, a corporation.
I think they probably spent more money on their attorneys in negotiating that settlement than they actually paid in the settlement.
No question. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, a big part of this that, I mean, addressing this problem is critical because it is worse than ever, but it has been a longstanding problem. So I think we need to look at solutions. And I think there are a lot of really good things happening, including laws at the state and local level to ban some of the most egregious practices. We have, I know you've had folks talk about the Big Cat Public Safety Act. That's a huge tool to end some of the most egregious practices. But what we've seen over and over again in the context of the Animal Welfare Act and in other animal protection statutes is that the law isn't worth anything if it's not enforced. So I think it's really important to be looking at citizen suit mechanisms. And that's why the Endangered Species Act has been so key for some of these bad actors, including Tim Stark, Dade City Wild Things, and others. Organizations and individuals have been able to step in, but that only applies to those animals who happen to be on the Endangered Species Act list. And there is a bill pending in Congress that I helped draft, the Animal Welfare Enforcement Improvement Act, which would add a citizen suit provision to the Animal Welfare Act, which I think is a really important piece of the puzzle if we're ever going to see things change. I mean, we shouldn't have to do the USDA's job for it, but it clearly has no interest in enforcing this law. And that's true from the beginning. I mean, when the Animal Welfare Act was passed, the USDA begged Congress not to give them responsibility for the statute. They made it absolutely clear that they were not interested in the statute, and we're seeing that play out still today.
Yeah. So, gosh, what do you think is the likelihood that your bill passes?
Federal legislation is incredibly difficult. It has 37 co-sponsors right now. It was introduced by Representative Krishnamurthy out of Illinois. And I definitely encourage folks to ask their representatives to co-sponsor it. That will help. But legislation is a long haul effort. It generally, I mean, as we know with the Big Cat Public Safety Act, it's making progress, but it has been years and years of effort. But we need to keep pushing for it. So I think eventually we do need to see this happen. It's going to be a huge help, but it's going to take some time and a lot of work. Similarly, I think we need, and there is no legislation introduced yet for this, but I think we need to be working on it. I think we need to have a new agency that is responsible for animal protection laws. We have an environmental protection agency. There's no reason we can't have an animal protection agency. The American public cares tremendously about animals and believes they should be treated well. And the USDA is not fulfilling its obligation. It's not fulfilling its mandates that Congress has given it under any animal protection statute, whether we're talking about the Animal Welfare Act, the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, the 28-hour law. Over and over again, the agency has made clear that its priorities are on promoting animal exploiting businesses, not protecting animals. And it has dual mandates in that vein. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise to us that they're shirking their responsibilities to animals. But we need to do something about that. And I would recommend that we have an independent agency with those responsibilities.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think that one of the things we didn't touch on in the whole, scope of the USDA being an agency protection organization, an exhibitor protection organization, its responses to the FOIA request when we had the whole black out happen and the refusal to respond to FOIA requests, and the USDA essentially creating its own category of exemption from FOIA and not wanting to embarrass licensees rather than disclosing public information that otherwise historically had been public, that should be public. But then really just creating this, its own way of insulating, licensees from any sort of, criticism or oversight, public oversight.
So what you're getting at is, in February 2017, the agency very abruptly deleted thousands of records from its website, that it had been on there for years and years and years, and which it had recognized it was required to post under the Freedom of Information Act affirmative disclosure mandates. And it said it was doing so to protect the personal privacy of regulated entities, but that we could still get the records through FOIA. And then, of course, when we tried to get them through FOIA, we waited years in many instances. And then the agency, as you said, responded that they were withholding them to, like, that is literally the wording they used. We're going to protect entities from, quote, embarrassment, which, of course, is not a basis for withholding under the Freedom of Information Act. So it was this interesting deployment of Exemption 6 and 7C under the FOIA, which protect personal privacy in many instances for corporate entities, such as GW Exotic, where the law is clear that corporations have no personal privacy interests. These are about protecting individuals and protecting things like your signature, your social security number, truly private information, which the agency had been redacting all of these years from the inspection reports. And so that began a long battle, including three lawsuits, two of which I was a plaintiff in. Efforts by Congress, appropriations language, nobody, well, very few people were happy with this. The AKC was happy with it, I guess. But even within industry, lots of folks came out and condemned it. The Association of Zoos and Aquariums was very clear that the availability of this data is their license to operate. That's how the public knows, you know, whether a facility is following the law or not. Speaking of research, which advocates animal research, also came out not as strongly as the ACA, but urged access to this information. Members of Congress, state law enforcement entities who rely on this information to enforce their own laws. Nobody, with rare exception, was happy with it. And yet it took, ramping up efforts, ongoing litigation. And then finally, on December 20th, President Trump signed into law an appropriations bill that mandated the USDA restore access to this information. And they actually asked, we gave them 60 days. They gave themselves more time to do so. And so just this weekend, their extended deadline that they gave themselves passed, and they have now restored all of the inspection report information that was previously available. What they have not restored, as I said before, are the enforcement records, which are really important. I mean, it's wonderful that we have the inspection report data, even though they're not citing things in the inspection reports as much, but we really, really need this enforcement information, and we're continuing to fight to get that information.
What do you think the impact has been on animals in licensed facilities, on the licensees, in these 3 years?
The thing is, I think it's been dire, but we don't know. That's the biggest problem. I mean, before we knew, we could at least go in and see what the USDA was noticing and standing by doing nothing about, and we could go in. We could go in and we could sue on behalf of those animals. We could go in and offer to rehome them. We could go in and offer to train the facility to better care for them. And there were an array of options, but we could at least do the USDA's job for it. And then for all of this time where they were withholding this information, we were in a black hole. We were in a void about what was going on with these animals. But we know for a fact from our own observations, from, you know, reports from whistleblowers, from reports from members of the public, that animals were suffering all this time. And that is absolutely on the USDA's hands.
Yeah, 100%. What's next? What do you think? I mean, your bill is pending for citizen suits, which would be key. I mean, we've seen how successful that has been with the Endangered Species Act in at least rescuing some of the protected animals. And the Cat Public Safety Act would also at least provide some legal mechanism to hopefully put a dent in some of the roadside zoo breeding that's incentivized by the allowance for public contact. What else? I mean, in the meantime, what else? What do you
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things and we need to be fighting this on all fronts. Another thing I want to make sure is on folks' radar is related to the license renewal issue. So I've been involved in about half a dozen lawsuits challenging the agency's policy of automatically renewing. The federal district court in DC just had an oral argument in one of those cases last week, and the USDA did propose in 2017 amending its regulations to do away with automatic license renewal and to condition license renewal on compliance with the Animal Welfare Act, as Congress required many years ago. And that rule, the agency claims, is with the Federal Register ready for publication any day now. So we need to be vigilant in monitoring what that final rule looks like, because as it was proposed by the agency, it was certainly a step in the right direction, but had some problems. My greatest fear is that they are going to rely on this concept of substantial compliance that we were talking about, and that they're going to automatically renew as long as there is so-called substantial compliance, which is highly problematic, because substantial compliance still means animals are suffering, and it violates the plain letter of the law, which says no license shall be issued unless compliance, full stop, has been demonstrated, because we're not talking about compliance with a very high level of requirements. It's a very low bar. So I think we need to hold the USDA's feet to the fire on these emergent issues, including license renewal and the ongoing transparency issues. We need to be thinking ahead, big picture, about addressing these Animal Welfare Act failings, including by adding a citizen supervision to the statute and getting the enforcement responsibilities out of the hands of an agency that has made absolutely clear it has no interest in enforcing this law. I also think we're seeing huge strides at the state and local level to ban some of the worst practices. And that's huge, because those are things that a local citizen can do. They can get, you know, cub petting banned in their locality. They can get wild animal circus exhibits banned in their community. And that is huge. And that helps us build the momentum for getting bans on the broader federal level eventually down the line. So I think that's important. Continuing with these Endangered Species Act suits is really important to helping these individual animals, but we can't just keep playing whack-a-mole with these bad guys. Like, they're gonna keep popping up in different places and different iterations. And ultimately, we need big picture policy fixes for these problems.
Agreed. I have a concern right now related to what's happening given COVID-19. How much confidence that we have? Do we have? I mean, I know what I suspect is happening, but how much confidence do we have that the USDA is actually continuing to inspect right now? And given that some of these roadside zoos are ramshackle and shoestring as it is, this seems like a time that's very ripe for animals to suffer pretty acutely in roadside zoos, particularly if the USDA is going to broaden its application of substantial compliance due to its own inability to do a lot of inspections, or its own will to do a lot of inspections and enforcement under the current dynamics.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought that up. It's hugely important. So we have no confidence. We have no reason to have any confidence. The USDA isn't even claiming that it's trying to do anything now. They actually published something saying, to the regulated entities, you know what, we get it. We understand if you don't want us to inspect you right now, so you can just tell us to go away and that'll be fine. So they're not doing routine inspections in the ways that they were before. They've also told regulated entities they can just send in photos to show what they've done rather than having inspectors come out. So no, they're doing absolutely nothing. And so this entire situation that we've been talking about is aggravated by the fact that these already non-compliant entities now have no check. And I think it's also really important to remember that the USDA has fallen down on its responsibilities to require these facilities to have plans in place to be prepared for catastrophes. So in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, where we saw animals die, many, many, many animals die as a result of the aftermath of the hurricane and electrical shutdowns and things like that, the USDA said, you know what, we need to require our licensed facilities to be prepared for emergencies and have disaster plans, and promulgated a rule that would have required agencies to have a plan in place and to train their employees about what they were going to do in any number of emergencies or disasters. And that rule was stayed by the agency years ago. They just abruptly stayed the rule. And as it was about to go into effect, as the facilities were about to have these plans in place, they said, you know what, we're not going to enforce that. And since then, Congress has been nudging the agency and making changes and saying, okay, now you can put the contingency plan rule back on the books. You know, we've gotten all of these roadblocks out of the way. There is no reason you can't have the contingency plan in place. And they still don't have it. And here we are in the midst of a massive disaster that is impacting huge numbers of animals. I mean, some facilities are just euthanizing their animals because they don't have any other plan for what to do with them. I would not be surprised in the least if we find out that many animals were just left behind to starve, at some point down the line when we start finding out what's going on while the USDA is not even inspecting. And once again, this is all blood on the USDA's hands because they recognized the need for these plans. They promulgated a rule and then they just stayed the rule indefinitely for years and years and years and still have done nothing.
Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. So it's even worse than I expected. Well, that, I think, God. It seems like a good place to end before we get more depressed.
I mean, I hate ending on a depressing note because so much of this is depressing, but there are so many amazing people doing incredible work here. And I mean, some of these animals are getting out as we speak, thanks to litigation and thanks to work, not that the USDA is doing, but that, you know, PETA and other organizations are doing. So it is not all hopeless. There is good stuff happening. I mean, USDA did finally revoke Tim Stark's license. Joe, of course, is not going to be exploiting any more animals. So we
Tim, sorry for interrupting. Tim appealed and then the appeal was denied, right? So is that
right? No, he can still appeal to a federal judge. And he probably will, and he'll probably lose. But in the USDA, as always, did too little too late, but it's still, we're in the right direction. The situation is going to improve, and it's good that we're having an opportunity to talk about all of this and just lay everything on the table and start talking about solutions, because that's the first step. If we don't know what we're looking at, we can't look at putting together a strategy to fix it. So I don't want it to be too bleak. I don't want folks to come away from this thinking like, this is just too awful, we can't do anything. There are absolutely things that each and every one of us can do.
For sure. No, I'm so glad you said that, because I do think that if there's a silver lining with Tiger King, it has given us an opportunity to capture the attention on an issue related to big cats and roadside zoos, even though that's not what Tiger King was actually about or focused on, but to redirect and to tell stories and to talk about what we all can do, whether it's as simple as never going to a roadside zoo or having a photo op, or, contacting our federal legislators and urging them to pass your bill and the Big Cat Public Safety Act. that, you know, there's all something that we can do to help bring about changes that reflect our values, because it's true. Like, I think what the Gallup poll said, like, what, 97 or 98% of people in the United States believe that animals should be protected from cruel treatment. So all of the things we're talking about are just necessary to fulfilling something that is already an American value.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think most Americans, I mean, I don't think this polling has been done, but I think most would believe that the USDA is actually doing something to protect these animals, or that some component of the federal government is. And so I think it's really important, since Erica and Rebecca didn't do this, that we enlighten the American public about the reality.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you go. I know how busy you are.
Thanks again for joining us today on Tiger Talk, everyone. If you haven't yet already emailed your federal legislators and asked them to co-sponsor the Big Cat Public Safety Act, please pause and take 2 minutes to do that right now. And be sure you also mention the Animal Welfare Enforcement Improvement Act. In tandem, these two pieces of federal legislation could do so much to bring an end to the chronic abuse, neglect, and exploitation of big cats in the United States. So until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, stay home, and I'll see you back here again soon on Tiger Talk.